Thank you, Jonathan, and thank you, David, for your kind invitation, and also for your gentle reminder to me to not to exceed 25 minutes. Bring you greetings from Archbishop Elliott. He takes a close and prayerful interest in this country and in the Church of England in particular. Just to tell you basically where I'm going, after an introduction, I'm going to talk about the disintegration of the state in the broadest sense of the word, the disintegration of the church, and then finally the recovery of the prophetic voice. And this is particularly a conversation, as it were, with Max Warren's 1964 lecture. So, first of all, how and why, contrasting Kenya and Great Britain. One of the few things I really miss, living as we do now in Kenya, is Radio 4's Today programme, even though I used to instinctively reach for the off button at the thought for the day slot. However, yesterday morning, I decided to continue listening, just in case, during my absence, there'd been an improvement. And the contributor happened to be a certain Francis Campbell, Vice-Chancellor of St. Mary's University College and one-time UK ambassador to the Holy See. And he was speaking about British values. And his essential point seemed to be that in a pluralist society, values, public values, should be concerned with the how rather than the why. We will never reach agreement on the why questions, but we can tackle the more practical question of how people with very different moral perspectives can live together peacefully and creatively. This is an illuminating distinction, but a refusal to deal with the why questions reflects the libertarian individualism, which is at the heart of our contemporary crisis of values. It means that as a nation, we have given up on an overarching narrative which is essential for any genuinely shared values. Let me illustrate from my experience of living in Kenya. It is a country struggling with tribalism, insecurity, corruption, and rickety infrastructure. Yet ordinary Kenyans have an irrepressible optimism and an unembarrassed religiosity. They are building a nation of which they are fiercely proud, which for all its problems is amongst the most developed in Africa, and through the state, and although the state is secular in that it recognises no one religion or denomination, religious belief is expressed quite naturally in the course of daily life. Soldiers ask me to pray for them, security guards ask me to give them a Bible verse for the day, and grace is the norm even before a cup of tea. The contrast with the UK is immediately obvious. Since 1963, the year Kenya was granted independence from Great Britain, the story of Kenya, despite many crises and setbacks, has been the growth of a newly emergent and purposeful nation. Whereas the story of Great Britain, despite rising material prosperity, has been of post-imperial decline and the slow death of its sense of identity and purpose. And I want us to hold this perspective because I believe that the contrast is a key to understanding both the reason why it has become so difficult to undergird British values with the Christian tradition and the quest for truthfulness in how the church should respond. I do entirely agree in principle with Max Warren's defence of an established church and its responsibilities to the state. But I believe that his model of the relationship between church and state as being like a marriage now needs major adjustment. Both parties have suffered a serious and possibly terminal disintegration of corporate personality over the last half a century. The need for a national church to serve the nation in prophesying, purifying, and preparing has never been greater, but the ability of that church to carry out those functions faithfully has never been weaker. the disintegration of the state. Last September, the United Kingdom came close to political disintegration, but this was a symptom of an underlying breakdown of values that had once underpinned the Union. It was widely remarked that Scottish nationalism was energised by a romantic narrative which the Unionists could not really match, but relied on instead on a more technocratic political and economic argument. David has already expertly mapped out for us the origin and nature of the dominant secular liberal individualism we live with today, and he noted the loss of a common framework of Christian assumptions has led to moral argument typically becoming, in the words of moral philosopher Alistair MacIntyre, civil war by other means. The Scottish referendum took on some of the rhetoric of civil war, and I want to explore MacIntyre's thought further. His important and perceptive book, After Virtue, first published in 1981, was perhaps ahead of its time, but is now certainly coming into its own, with the prediction that the West is heading for a new dark age. He draws a crucial distinction between two very different ways of understanding values. Firstly, for both historic Christian and classic Aristotelian ethics, what is virtuous is governed teleologically. It has a purpose. It is that which men and women aspire to do and be when they align their lives with an overarching purpose. In the Aristotelian tradition, it was the good and glory of the earthly city. In the Christian tradition, as famously articulated by Augustine, it is the fulfilment and glory of the city of God. To refer back to my introductory comment, these are values that answer the question of purpose as well as practice, the why as well as the how. In contrast, modern secular liberal societies have a notion of virtue which becomes impossible to sustain in the absence of a common moral framework. Instead, the more neutral term of values is preferred, and these values essentially revolve around a sense of fairness as neutrality, with an emphasis on terms like equality, respect, and diversity. The why is left to one side as a private commitment of the individual, and values become instead a concern with the how. And as we saw yesterday, the objectivity of natural rights is then eroded by the essentially arbitrary objectivity of so-called parliamentary rights, which leads inexorably to the tyranny of the 51%. The innovation of so-called gay marriage is an icon of secular libertarianism and neatly illustrates the distinction I have just mentioned. Marriage is no longer about the purpose of procreation and establishing a family and the fulfilment of what it means to be male and female in the image of God. Now it becomes something about personal fulfilment of the autonomous individual, cheerfully established by Parliament in defiance of Scripture, the natural order, and over a millennia in which the laws of England have been founded on Christian teaching. To put this in historical context, there is an instructive comparison with Wilberforce's campaign to abolish the slave trade. After a campaign beginning in 1787, the slave trade was abolished in the British Empire 20 years later in 1807. But it signified much more than the end of slavery. It heralded a century in which the moral and cultural fabric of Great Britain was deeply penetrated by evangelical Christianity. 200 years on from Wilberforce's great achievement, we see a contemporary campaign in the name of a secular notion of equality that emulates Wilberforce's methods but precisely reverses his achievement and in a similar timescale. The journey from Section 28 of the Local Government Act of 1988, banning the promotion of homosexuality in schools, to the Marriage Same-Sex Couples Act of 2013, took just 25 years and represented a massive change in public opinion led by political activists and interest groups. The passing of so-called gay marriage into law is much more than a recognition of a change in sexual ethics. It is a decisive rejection of the Judeo-Christian tradition, which both reflects and reinforces social disintegration. It does so, firstly, constitutionally. Constitutionally, a basic protection of liberty has been breached. As a sovereign under God, the phrase used by Max Warren, the monarch embodies the idea of the nation being under God. If this is to mean anything, there must be certain defining values that are understood to transcend the parliamentary process. So if the royal assent, premised on the monarch's oath to maintain the laws of God and the true profession of the gospel, unquote, could be given to a law that seeks to overturn something as fundamental to the Christian tradition and revelation as the nature of marriage, are there any circumstances in which it may not be given? If Parliament can take upon itself the right to define the nature of marriage, something which previous generations have taken as given by God and embedded in the very nature of what it means to be human, what may it not try and do? Secondly, this legislation, this unprecedented legislation, reinforces social disintegration culturally. We've become self-destructive. The loss of a national narrative that gives substance to common values has been described by Bishop Michael Nazirali as a form of national amnesia. It is instructive to link this with Alistair MacIntyre's insight that being able to locate ourselves in a history is essential for a proper account of self-identity. He writes, "When someone complains, as do some of those who attempt or commit suicide, that his or her life is meaningless, he or she often, and perhaps characteristically, is complaining that the narrative of their life has become unintelligible to them, that it lacks any point, any movement towards a climax or telos. What is true of an individual is also true of a nation, if we follow Max Warren's high view of a nation, when he writes, quote, if one accepts a biblical understanding of history, then nations are part of a providential ordering of human life. National self-consciousness, like individual self-consciousness, is something good in itself, however much it may be distorted to evil ends." Now, Max Warren assumed a fully functioning national self-consciousness, but are we now committing a slow suicide? Radical individualistic libertarianism that has cut us off from an unembarrassed sense that being British means sharing in a common moral heritage and habits. Like the ash tree, we are suffering from a seemingly unstoppable dieback of national consciousness, and meanwhile the rise of movements with a strong narrative to answer the why as well as the how continues. Scottish nationalism offering a new and confident nationalistic narrative. UKIP reacting to the sense that many have of Britain, and England in particular, as no longer being home. And Islamic jihadism making violence a virtue in the service of a revived caliphate and a fast track to heaven. These are all, in their different ways, signs of that death and disintegration of a properly national consciousness. The disintegration of the church. So can the church breathe life into this state that is dying a self-inflicted moral and spiritual death? Max Warren rightly identifies the primary responsibility of the church, especially a national church, as prophetic. And at the end of his first lecture, he concludes, quote, and I need hardly add, the national church, which thus prophesies to the nation and to the nation state, stands under the very same judgment which it is called to proclaim. It, like the state, is under God. Now, if that is a statement of what is rather than what ought to be, what hardly needed to be added in 1964 is now highly questionable. As with the state, it is far from clear that the Church of England functions today as under God in any meaningful sense of the word. To be under God means to be subject to his word and to be sent by him. But the evidence suggests that the Church of England has become very reticent to proclaim its confidence in that one word by which it is supposed to live. Firstly, a mistaken principle. It is highly ironic that the British government's concern with British values first came to prominence as a result of the former Archbishop of Canterbury's promotion, not of law inspired by Christian faith, but of Islamic Sharia law. Archbishop Rowan Williams' lecture of February 2008, Civil and Religious Law in England, A Religious Perspective, encouraged the recognition of Islamic religious values through the formal recognition of some aspects of Sharia in parallel with existing laws. Following an overwhelmingly negative public reaction, the Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, asserted that British law must be based on British values, while, as John Milbank dryly observes, reminding the populace that it, the government, had set up a committee in order to discover just what those values might be. Although roundly criticised, Rowan Williams was in fact being entirely consistent with that form of negative Hegelianism associated with the British philosopher Gillian Rose, that I argued in my book Shadow Gospel provides an underlying coherence to his theology. At its heart lies a commitment to the integrity of a dialectic in which the willingness to be dispossessed, not just of self-interest, but of also of what we think to and know to be right, has a central place. In the case of the debate on Sharia law, the underlying problem was Rowan Williams' willingness to be dispossessed of a commitment to the Judeo-Christian tradition as the nation's cultural meta-narrative. The result of this thinking continues in the church now. It allows itself to be marginalised through being subsumed into a wider entity called people of faith, and has to compete for attention by loudly espousing the enthusiasms of the day, becoming, to borrow a phrase from E.M. Forster, poor little talkative Christianity, with a continual stream of political and social punditry, which is something we are sadly very familiar with today. Secondly, there is a mistaken pragmatism. Rowan Williams' attempt to apply his Hegelianism to the conflicts which erupted in the Anglican Communion shortly after he assumed office did not bear fruit. Unfortunately for him, his political skills did not match his theological sophistication. His successor, however, has a rather different skill set, with stronger political abilities. Justin Welby now routinely refuses to answer questions from the media about his position on gay marriage, despite his opposition to it as Parliament debated the proposed legislation less than 2 years ago. And it is not as though there is much hope of future clarity, because we now know that the Pilling Report's facilitated conversations are not about discerning truth, but about learning to live with difference. The House of Bishops itself has said of the Pilling facilitated conversations that, quote, there is no expectation of achieving any consensus in either direction in the foreseeable future. The Archbishop and the Anglican Communion Office are now promoting the same approach throughout the Anglican Communion through the Continuing Indaba project, which is designed to treat doctrinal issues that have torn the fabric of the Anglican Communion as if they were merely pastoral problems of misunderstanding. As Dr. Martin Davey concludes in his recent review of the Anglican Communion Office's publication, Living Reconciliation, it is effectively a blank check for the acceptance of any and every possible form of deviation from New Testament Christianity. So as we think about the future, I do not see how we can have any realistic expectation that the Church of England will be a safe place for the gospel. Living with the theological cancer of false teaching is going to be made the norm. The first stage was that of institutionalised hypocrisy, in which the official teaching of the Church was routinely ignored and breaches went undisciplined. The ground rules for facilitated conversations show us that the second stage is going to be the officially sanctioned departure of the Church of England from being, in any coherent sense, under God, or through being under the Word of God. And if it is not under the Word of God, there can be no real, genuine prophetic role. So finally, recovering the true prophetic voice. Where do we go from here? Max Warren assumed a state with an essentially unified national consciousness and a national church that had at least the capacity to speak under God prophetically to the state. Neither of those assumptions is tenable today. Here I want to develop an idea of Alistair MacIntyre's. The only values which can provide a solid foundation for human flourishing are those that answer the why questions. They're about what human beings are becoming. They are objectively given and embody aims and a purpose which necessarily lead to a narrative not just of the individual life, but also of whole communities. So at the close of his book, MacIntyre, writing in 1981, remember, makes an appeal for a new Saint Benedict. He writes, "A crucial turning point," this is in early European history, "occurred when men and women of goodwill turned aside from the task of shoring up the Roman Imperium and ceased to identify the continuation of civility and moral community with the maintenance of that imperium. What they set themselves to achieve instead was the construction of new forms of community within which the moral life could be sustained so that both morality and civility might survive the coming ages of barbarism and darkness. What matters at this stage is the construction of local forms of community in which civility and intellectual and moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us." End of quote. My brief survey of state and nation suggests that the church will only recover its prophetic voice when, to slightly adapt MacIntyre, we cease to identify the maintenance of Church of England structures with the maintenance of the gospel as the Church of England has received it. It is time to set ourselves to achieve new forms of faithful ecclesial community through which the prophetic word can be heard clearly in a dying culture with spiritual power and intellectual grip. There can be no convincing narrative apart from a convincing Christian community. Let me conclude. We should not abandon our vocation as members of a national church, but the authentic prophetic voice will only be heard from a confessing church which wholeheartedly embraces the faith as the Church of England has received it, but may or may not intersect with the institutional structures of the Church of England. A confessional rallying point already exists within the Anglican Communion. We have the GAFCON movement and the Anglican Mission in England, so we do not need to stop being Anglicans. And neither should we seek to leave the Church of England, but we should not shrink from exile if it comes. Thank you.